In many ways, the story of the war, the Black Hawk War, has been the creation myth for our region, and the war itself, the Big Bang that created Wisconsin. Before the war, there was no Wisconsin, just the wild western extension of the Michigan territories, where French and Native participants in the fur trade seemed caught in the endless cycles and rhythms of nature.
The Black Hawk War took the lives of fewer than 75 Americans and lasted less than 4 months. But in the 175 years since it took place, we've gained perspective on its impact on the history of Wisconsin and America. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What led to the outbreak of the Black Hawk War? How capable a leader and strategist was Black Hawk himself? And how did the war affect some of its major participants, major at least in retrospect, including two future U.S. presidents and the president of the Confederacy? Our guest is Carrie A. Trask, professor of history with the UW Colleges and author of the book Black Hawk, The Battle for the Heart of America, published by Henry Holt and Company in 2006.
Well, welcome to University of the Year.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
You point out that Black Hawk is such a popular figure in sort of the American imagination that we have, for example, here in Wisconsin, Black Hawk parks, Black Hawk camps, Black Hawk lots of things. Why is that?
Oh, wow. I mean, really, truly, the number of books published, the number of articles written, the number of parks and schools and banks and savings and loans. In many ways, it allows areas of this state and northern Illinois, places where, well, you'd be hard-pressed to really find anything much of a history, certainly much of an exciting history to have happened, except, you know, in 1832, there was an Indian uprising. And because Black Hawk and the army and the Illinois militia traveled so far and wide in this region, every little place from Soldier's Grove to Kellogg's Grove and all along the way, you know, can kind of claim part of that history. And in many ways, like I said in the intro, the war becomes a creation myth. It really truly is the first historical event for a lot of the region in Wisconsin and Illinois.
It was a pretty wide open territory in 1832.
Oh, 1832, there were only 3,000 people living in Wisconsin, or what later becomes Wisconsin, and there were only really two major settlements in Green Bay, and still called LeBay at the time, and in Prairie du Chien. And there was a little cluster of people that made their living off the fur trade and portage. But other than that, it was wide open territory. In fact, the war itself kind of becomes an exploration of some of the country around here. Once they, that is the army and the militia, take off from Four Lakes, which is right here in Madison, and head off towards the Mississippi River, heading northwest out of Dane County, which wasn't even in existence at the time, they're into really, truly unknown territory. I mean, in many ways, even the Indians are not very familiar with the hills and the dense forests of western Wisconsin. And so places that had never been seen by Americans all of a sudden became kind of familiar areas, at least to the people who were tramping through at that time.
What about northern Illinois? What do we have in northern Illinois?
Northern Illinois is a little bit more settled. I mean, there's Dixon's Ferry, which later turns into Dixon, which has one house and one stable and a ferry. But with the lead rush in the northwest part of Illinois, you get all of a sudden this sort of explosive creation of Galena and small settlements around there, mining settlements, smelting settlements, because they would look for stands of hardwood so they could use that as fuel to smelt the ore with. And so southwest Wisconsin, places like Dodgeville and Platteville, and northwest Illinois, there is some settlement. I mean, there really is a kind of a rushing in of people. There's a kind of hard times economically back east, and lead is a highly valued natural resource for a lot of reasons.
You have a picture of Black Hawk on the cover of your book. Can you tell us about him, his early life, where he comes from before Wisconsin?
Sure, I can. His early life, he probably was born in Sauconock, which is the Big Sauk summer settlement, which is too much alliteration, I guess, but near the confluence of the Rock and the Mississippi River. And all the Sauk people in the world, except a small band that lived in Missouri, you know, they gathered there. And he was probably born there About 1763, probably, you know, in the period just as what becomes the American Revolution begins to shake the ground a little. And he lives there his entire life until they're cast off into exile in 1832. And when Black Hawk leads his band back across the Mississippi River, he's 65 years old. He's a man that's clearly for the time and for his culture, a man whose better days is supposedly behind him. As a young man, he'd been a pretty famous warrior. He had also fought in the War of 1812 on the British side, had seen experience in and around the area of Detroit, had come home, had been involved in some major battles in the Mississippi River Valley, where at the end of the war in 1814, there was quite a lot of action. But after that, he becomes pretty much of a private person, is very much a family-oriented man, is very caring towards his children, and unlike a lot of his comrades, only has one wife, and from all appearances, it was a very affectionate and bonded relationship. And it's only late in life that he emerges once again. In the early 1831, and then in 31 and 32, he reappears. And he's not a chief. He's not part of the clan that produced the civil chiefs. He had been a war leader, but he had no formal sort of institutional position.
And what brings him out then in 1830, 1831?
I think a sadness and a rage brings him out, in that what's happening at the time is that really up until about 1832, the Sauk had been a very thriving people. I mean, they had a very complex and productive economy. They did cottage industry. They made sugar out of the maple sap. They were in the fur trade. They grew a huge amount of agricultural surplus, in which they sold the surplus into the fur trade, and were in many ways on a cash economy or a very complex barter economy. And unlike a lot of the tribes, certainly the legendary tribes that seemed to be withering away at the time, the Sauk are actually gaining in population. And one of the reasons why is because partly because of their prosperity and partly because they abstain from the use of liquor. And, you know, the liquor, which has been so much of a part of the fur trade and so much a part of frontier expansion, I mean, liquor is really like a food with Americans in the early 19th century.
I read somewhere that the consumption 1835 compared to now is 5-1 per
capita. It's 5-1, yeah. It was huge. I mean, it was just huge. And so what happens in many of the Indian communities is that whiskey really is a horrendous ravager. I mean, it really, truly, like, just destroys the society in a matter of years. Well, the Sauk abstained. They pretty much abstained.
And why? Do we know
why? Why they did is, well, part of why they did is because, on the one hand, in the negative, sort of the negative dimension to it, they're very, very anti-American. They don't want to be like America. They don't want to act like Americans. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to eat the same food. And in many ways, they really see the Americans as a kind of a chaos, which, of course, is a pretty accurate description, I think, of the people pouring west, especially in the lead rush.
Better to ally with the French or better to ally with
right.
the British, anybody
and,
but
and
those
with,
Americans.
And with the British, basically advise them to sort of stay away. And there's real regulation in terms of the whiskey trade, much more with the British. And there's a very close and ongoing relationship with the British, who are still, I mean, Wisconsin is still at this time up until the War of 1812. It's still British. I mean, it's the British that are in Green Bay and the British who are in Prairie du Chien. And some of those British, of course, are French Canadians who had become part of the British Empire in 1763. And their attitude is very, very different. I mean, they certainly do have their drinking bouts. You know, at the time of rendezvous in the spring when the furs come in, they'll have a binge, but it's not a steady consumption. But they see what happens to other tribes. For example, Black Hawk is very, very critical of the Fox, the Meskwaki, who are kindred to them in terms of language and very similar in culture and religion. They're drinkers. They're drinkers, and they're having a hard time. So Black Hawk himself, up until after the war, is absolutely not into being white in any kind of way. And there's pretty much a following of people who emulate his example, and I think that's really where his power comes from. Because what happens after 1822 is that, number one, the fur trade changes. The American Fur Company comes in, and it has very, very different attitudes from the French and the British. I mean, they are our business. John Jacob Astor is a millionaire getting richer all the time, and they want to come in and they want to maximize profit, you know, clean the region out and then move on up the Missouri. So the nature of the fur trade changes, and one of the things that is really very, very important to the change in the fur trade is that it's not until 1823 that there are steel traps that are used in trapping animals. I mean, up until that time, the fur trade had been really a hunt. And pretty traditional technologies and pretty traditional methods had been used. But once they start using, you know, you'd say, wow, not a very complex piece of technology. But once they start using steel traps, it's not long before the animals are on the verge of extinction.
Mm-hmm. And then with more time to drink.
Give you more time to drink, yeah. Give you more time to drink. And the other thing that the American Fur Company does that is really very ruinous, and, you know, we probably should all pay attention to this, is they do a lot of business on credit. So what happens is the Sauk hunters get indebted. And once they get indebted, I mean, truly they have lost their autonomy. So that's happening. The nature of the fur trade is changing in radical ways. Good for the company. It's a little like, you know, multinationals all over the world. It's sort of good for the company, but not necessarily good for the natural resources of the area or the native people. But the other thing that happens, too, is after 1822, the government starts doing leases on territory that has lead in it. And all of a sudden, you get the lead rush. So a culture that had been very, very solid, secure, and flourishing is all of a sudden hit by these very, very horrendous changes. And they stop being themselves. I mean, they start to change into something else. And there's a real, I argue at least, and I think it's probably an argument that certainly has some validity, otherwise I wouldn't have pursued it. But there really is an identity crisis among the Sauk. Like, who are they and what are they becoming? And, you know, what are they supposed to do about it? And unlike us, who an identity crisis is part of the very way of life, I mean, they really have this sense of collective self that has been very, very strong. And all of a sudden, that's more than ebbing away. I mean, it really truly is eroding very rapidly. And Black Hawk is this traditionalist who dresses in traditional clothing, who eats traditional food, and who is a man who's like clearly and dramatically connected to the past greatness, and who has a medicine bag that dates back, he claims, a medicine bag, which is, you know, a way of getting supernatural power on your side. He has a medicine bag that he claims dates right back to the very founding of the tribe. So he's a man who's really connected to the traditional identity and the traditional, all the traditional metaphors and all the traditional symbols. And I think he really derives an awful lot of power from that, a lot of influence, which is certainly what you're talking about in Native American societies when you talk about power. There's no power like, you know, the power to command, but there is the power to influence.
You don't hear as much about disease as being a factor in hollowing out tribes in this part of the country as much as you do, say, among the eastern tribes?
Not as much. Not as much. And I'm not exactly sure why, unless there – certainly in the 16th century, there's some bad epidemics. The Jesuit relations, of course, indicate that there are tremendous problems with smallpox, for example. But maybe over the period of time, one of the things that happens, one of the developments that occurs with Native people, especially in this part of the country, is there's a lot of intermarriage. I mean, the fur trade is a real commerce. There's a lot of intermarriage, not just between the French and the natives, but there's a lot of intermarriage among the tribes. And it may, in fact, result in, boy, no authority here, no scientific authority on my part, but there may, in fact, been like a kind of a genetic strengthening as a result.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that diversity. Yeah.
You write about how vitally important storytelling is as a way of preserving traditions. And when you're talking about the identity crisis that Black Hawk and others would have felt, how did the stories then become a way of recording that change?
Well, the stories, you know, among natives, the stories are still very powerful. And Leslie Silko, who was a Cherokee, I think, in her novel, Ceremony talks about, you know, and I use that in the book, you know, stories have this sort of power. I mean, Silko writes, "I will tell you something about stories," he said. This is one of her characters. "They aren't just entertainment. Don't be fooled. They are all we have, you see, all we have to fight off illness and death. You don't have anything if you don't have the stories." And I think that certainly with the natives, that's really important, because the stories, I mean, these are oral people. And their whole way of preserving culture is narrative. It's like they gather around and people tell the stories. And from that, they not only learn the lessons and the roles of life, but they also transfer a tremendous amount of cultural knowledge, one from the other. And the stories get retold and retold and retold. It's not that they're changeless necessarily, but the stories change slowly enough that there's this sense of continuity and connection, and have a tremendous amount to do with how people see themselves and what they seek to emulate in the world. The stories, certainly they're the creation stories, but they're the trickster tales as well. And in many ways, the stories are, as Silko suggests, a real survival tool. Gerald Visner, who's a Métis, has written a lot about tricksters and trickster tales, and about how the trickster tales can only be told between the very first frost, you know, in late October, and the sighting of the first geese, you know, flying north in the spring. And what they are is they're funny stories. They're funny stories that, of course, get their minds off the misery of the winter. They laugh instead of sit around and complain about being hungry. But most of all, with the stories, they gather together. So that there's real comfort in the darkness of midwinter, and a kind of a real laughter about the nature of life in some ways. And so in lots and lots of ways, the people become their stories. And I make the same argument for people like Henry Dodge. I mean, the big story, of course, the big story in the American experience at this time are the hunter-hero stories from really the end of the 17th century, from really the time of King Philip's War on. You know, the real heroic stories in American culture were the hunter heroes. And Richard Slotkin, in his book, A Regeneration Through Violence, really tells the Central American myth. And it really remains the Central American myth until Gunsmoke goes off the television, I think. And it really truly is about men with guns who really are a type that persist. They're tough. They're Indian-like. They're shooters, they're individualists, and they are really heroic. And so the tales that get told, and there's lots and lots of them in print, but the tales that get told and the tales that get read, and certainly reading is an individual way of communicating rather than the stories that are done orally, you get sort of the emergence of these kinds of men. I mean, Andrew Jackson, of course, is probably the poster boy for the myth. And there are a lot of men at the time, including Henry Dodge, who becomes the first territorial governor of Wisconsin, who very much emulates the example of Andrew Jackson, but also very much emulates and plays out the example in the hunter-hero stories.
And would you say then that Black Hawk would have viewed himself as a sort of trickster figure?
Yeah, I think Black Hawk thinks of himself as kind of a trickster.
And the trickster would be someone hard to catch, someone
hard to catch.
Changing shape.
The trickster is like, oh, he's all things, you know. He's magical, but he's mortal. He's spiritual and carnal. But the deal with the trickster is the trickster can change shape. And certainly within Native American culture, the power to metamorphose is like, wow, it is the power. And so when Black Hawk is engaged in the war, what he really is doing is he's trying not to be engaged in the war. He really understands and is terrified by especially the militia, because they're undisciplined, they're unrestrained, they are really out for blood. These guys are, you know, scalp collectors. And in fact, there's all kinds of references and accounts of how they really are out hunting for trophies in many ways. So what Black Hawk's strategy is in many parts of the war is to vanish, is to change shape, is to disappear, is to always be fooling the people who are on his trail, rather than sort of standing and fighting, although that occurs as well. But I think that in lots of ways he reflects that culture. And of course the Americans are very frustrated because boy, he isn't fighting the right way. You know, he's not fighting the right way.
It's like the Americans didn't fight the British the right way in New Orleans.
Yeah.
They used the Indian tactics.
And what they do is they Black Hawk kind of ridicules the American approach to warfare. And with the natives, I mean, the key is to, like, boy, hit your enemy where they're the weakest, you know, and get the biggest bang for your buck on whatever violence you do. So what the Sauk do, along with some of their supporters, there's some Winnebagos and some Potawatomi from western Wisconsin and northern Illinois who also kind of join in on this. They attack very small settlements or isolated farmsteads, and they do terror. They do terror. And the terror is a way of amplifying the effect. They can't do it in numbers, and they certainly have
just killing somebody isn't as effective as killing them and carving them up.
Absolutely not. I mean, boy, you carve them up and it gets news. I mean, it's a story that goes through the whole territory, and everybody knows, and everybody is made more frightened by it.
There's a drawback to that, though. We'll look.
There is, yes.
We'll look at one of those other persons you mentioned who is maybe about as different from Black Hawk as he can be, but happened to have been the commander-in-chief of the American side, and that's Andrew Jackson, and we'll find out what set this Black Hawk War off also when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from AIG Travel Guard, insuring travelers worldwide and providing IT careers and advancement opportunities within a rapidly expanding company. Career information online at travelguard.com/careers.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Carrie Trask, and our topic for this conversation of University of the Air, the Black Hawk War of 1832, a formative event in the history of Wisconsin and in some ways of the United States as well. We've learned quite a bit about the Sauk, these people so rooted in the land in Wisconsin and northern Illinois, and how do they contrast with those Americans who are pouring into the region?
One of the real contrasts, I mean, this war is really important, it seems to me, as an insight into culture. I mean, there are a lot of people that write the story of the war as a military story. And that's perfectly fine. There's a new book out by a young historian in Milwaukee. His name is Patrick Young, and it's quite a good book, and it's called The Black Hawk War of 1832. And it's much more of a military account. But culturally, it seems to me, the real war is between two groups of people that are absolutely, you know, so entirely different from one another. And there's some real irony, of course, in some of their differences. And I deal with the Americans in this period of time, the Americans in this part of the world is essentially people of process, people of motion, people of sound and fury, you know, with no roots, with no commitment to community, with no relationships in a social way, out to make their fortunes and do it as quickly as possible. Whereas the natives, the Sauk, are really, you know, in spite of the reputation that the Indians were wanderers with no fixed abodes, the Sauk are very, very much people of place. They're very much people of place. And the place for them, the center of the world for them, was a large village called Sauconock. And I'm not sure you should call it a village either. It's a large community. It's actually, you know, when everybody's home and the Sauk all return to Sauconock in late March and remain there until early October, the population of Sauconock was much larger than the population of St. Louis, of Chicago, of Prairie du Chien, of all the other quote-unquote major settlements in the upper Mississippi. But it was more than just a community. I mean, it was really where everything came together for them. In fact, they bring the dead home from their winter camps in western Iowa to bury them on the bluff above Sauconock along the Rock River. And so it really truly is like a central focus, a central place, a very large embodiment of who they are. And Black Hawk is especially attached to it. I mean, he's lived there his whole life. He's very much attached to it. And in his autobiography, he says, "When I call to mind the scenes of my youth and those of later days and reflect upon the theater in which these were acted, had been for so long the home of my fathers, who now slept on the hills around it, I could not bring my mind to consent to leaving this country for any earthly considerations.
We've had a little bit of an insight into Black Hawk, the man as a leader, maybe in some ways an unlikely leader even. But these policies that are putting the Sauk into conflict with these Americans, these policies are being, if not proposed, they're certainly being espoused by Andrew Jackson, who's about as different from Black Hawk as he can be, as you've suggested.
Well, I think he is a lot different than Black Hawk, although, boy, they're both warriors, you know. They both got their fame sort of in doing violent things. And Jackson, you know, Jackson's real loyal to his constituents like Black Hawk. And his constituents are, well, largely people in the South and largely people in the West and of course, the great driving force in the American country in the early 19th century is the market system revolution. And we like to think of it as like, boy, it's you know, the expansion of the frontier. But what's really happening is that, boy, the United States is becoming a very, very productive capitalist economy. And it's spreading west very, very rapidly because, well, you know, there's a lot of land that's very productive. And people move a lot. Most you take, for example, the Lincoln family. I mean, I think the Lincoln family moved about six times. You know, they never stayed on a farm longer than 4 or 5 years, and then the topsoil was sort of worn out. But Jackson, because there's this great expansion and the population of the country is increasing by about 30% every 10 years, boy, the hunger for land is just absolutely insatiable. So in 1830, Jackson persuades the Congress to pass the Indian Removal Act, which states that all the tribes living east of the Mississippi River will be on some schedule to be removed and resettled in territory west of the Mississippi River. And the Sauk, of course, are on the list. I mean, they really are kind of formally removed in 1831.
To Iowa?
To Iowa. Yeah, to Iowa.
And knowing what you read about Black Hawk and what he said about the land and how important it was, the connection with the ancestors, the news coming to Black Hawk and the others of his tribe must have been devastating.
Oh, absolutely devastating. I mean, they really not only had very, very extensive gardens, cornfields, and cemeteries. I mean, everything that was important in their life was there. I mean, not just their economy, but you know, everything they really valued and cared about was somehow in the physical embodiment of that settlement. And so to be cast out was really to be exiled to Iowa. And I don't want to be too disparaging about Iowa, but wow, it was just like
tall grass.
It was thick soil. Yeah, it was like being sent to Siberia is what it was. And the women complained about the thick sod, and they couldn't really work the land as they had, and their children were hungry. And there's conflict with other tribes that are already living there. It's just not a good solution at all.
Very different hunting too.
And very different.
And how did they understand? I mean, when the news came that they had to be removed, did they understand why it was happening and how it was going to be enforced?
Well, there's a split in the tribe. There really is a split in the tribe, and there are two factions. And one faction is led by an important man by the name of Keokuk, who is an accommodationist. He says, boy, you know, you can't beat them. You may as well join them. You may as well do what they say and make the best of adjustments. And a lot of people sort of in a kind of a despair kind of acquiesce into that and go to Iowa. Whereas Black Hawk is saying, absolutely not. Absolutely not. This is unfair, and we never really did sell this land, although, you know, there's certainly documents, written documents that indicate that the land was sold, whether it was sold fairly or not. And the Black Hawk faction, really, they just believe that they just can't be themselves anymore. I mean, they'll cease to be who they are if they're exiled from Sauk.
And so how do the events unfold then of this war, of this conflict?
Well, they're removed in 31. They're removed by a military force in 31, and Black Hawk spends the winter brooding over it, and they're hungry because, you know, they've been kicked out of Sauconock before they were able to harvest their crops.
And when you say removed, how? Like just herded off, chased with guns?
Chased with guns.
Stuck on boats and taken across the river.
Well, they mostly made it across the river by their own devices. I mean, a lot of the older people and the women and the children go across in canoes, and the men go across with the horses. There's a fairly large military force, the United States Army, that comes up from Jefferson Barracks, south of St. Louis. But there's an even larger Illinois militia led by John Reynolds, who's the governor, who's always looking for – he's an Andrew Jackson type, too.
Looking for some press.
He's always looking for press. And being tough on Indians is like, you know, it's the best way to get headlines. So really, they leave before there's really a violent confrontation. And then the militia, the Illinois militia, moves into Sauconock and, you know, desecrates the graves and burns down the lodges and makes it really apparent that they're not welcome in Illinois. So they do spend the winter in central Iowa on the Des Moines River, and they're hungry. They hadn't been able to harvest their crops. They are depressed. I mean, wow, you know, this is a big, big, big loss to them. And so Black Hawk gets encouragement from a religious man known as the Winnebago Prophet. And the Winnebago Prophet says, oh, come back in the spring. You know, come back in the spring, and if you can't return to Sauconock, come back and, you know, come up to my village and grow your corn in the homeland again. And then there's a report from a young war chief by the name of Neopope, who's been to see the British at Fort Malden, which is just across from Detroit. And Neopope comes back and he tells Black Hawk that if he returns with his people, the British will provide support, maybe even in the form of soldiers, and won't permit the Americans to rough him up. So with all of that kind of cooking around, you know, in his thoughts, he decides in late March to return.
And how many people were sort of followers of Black Hawk? How big a group is this?
There's range here. Certainly some of the Indian agents claim it was a group of about 1,500 or 1,600. Other people claim that it was around 1,000 to 1,100 people, but somewhere between 1,100 and 1,600. And there are women, children, old people. There's about 500 to 600 warriors. So what it is, like, it's the whole cross-section of Sauk society. It's not just kind of a quote-unquote an Indian army that's crossing over.
And where do they go if they can't go to the hometown?
Well, what happens is they cross the Mississippi River at a place called Yellow Banks, which is, oh, I can't tell you what town is there now, but it's further south. It's down near where the Illinois flows into the Mississippi. And they move up. The warriors on horseback in Black Hawk move up with the old people and some of the women, the east bank of the Mississippi, and other people take the baggage in the canoes. There's well over 100 canoes that are heading north up the Mississippi in early April 1832, and they do reach the place of Sauconock, but boy, there's a military force already that has come up. And so they head up the Rock River towards what now is Prophetstown, Illinois, which was the village of the Winnebago Prophet. But they know that they're going to be followed. And they also know that it's not just the regular troops. And Black Hawk appreciates that, and so do the regular troops. They appreciate that there's a real difference in quality of fighting forces, that the regular troops are disciplined, they're under professional officers. And General Atkinson, Henry Atkinson, is a pretty wise man, I think, in many ways, and that he's been on the frontier for quite a while. And Atkinson gets a kind of a, you know, a bad rep with historians because he had no combat experience. But Atkinson, in many ways, is more of a peacemaker than a warrior. And in some ways, is like just really very good for the situation. So I think Atkinson really wants to keep the peace, essentially.
And is this where Abraham Lincoln comes into the story?
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln certainly comes into the story. He's working in a general store in New Salem at the time. And he signs up, and he has some political ambitions at the time. He signs up with the militia.
And what does he think he's signing up? And he's signing up to – what does he think he's signing up to do?
I think Lincoln – well, I think Lincoln is not really clear. I think the thought is that what they'll do is they'll march up. They'll ride up. I mean, they're all on horses. They'll ride up to the Rock River Valley, and they'll intimidate the Indians to return to the west side of the Mississippi. But it was one of these – the militia that gathers in Beardstown. There are people from all over the settled region of southern Illinois, and it's as much social as it is military. I mean, it's the spring of the year. You know, people are kind of coming out of their caves from the winter. But it's 1832, and 1832, of course, you know, it's an even-numbered year, so there's got to be an election, right? And so if you want to run for office of any kind, it's the perfect place to be. I mean, women don't vote, and all the men, you know, and all the farms and the small towns, they're joining up with the militia. So it's an awfully good opportunity to, you know, share drinks and talk politics and get support. And the way of getting support, of course, is that all the militia officers are elected. So, you know, you get to run for office with people, and you get to be in a relationship to them that you already have established a position of leadership.
A little bit of political base you can build.
Oh, it's a political base for sure. And Lincoln is elected. Lincoln is elected captain of his company, which is, he says later on, was probably the most satisfying election he had ever had. But he's, you know, he's in his early 20s, and he hasn't held a civic office. But he's a captain, and he's pretty enthusiastic about it all. And so they get on their horses at Beardstown, and they ride over to the Mississippi River and then ride up the Mississippi River following the trail left behind by the Sauk. And Lincoln stays in quite a long time. He makes it all the way up to Lake Koshkonong in June and early July of 32, at which point a lot of the militia are sent home because they're eating too much.
but Lincoln had no qualms about the mission.
Did he ever actually see any Sauk?
He claims he didn't. He saw the results of the Sauk at one point. He's on a burial detail on two, I guess, after Stillman's Run. There's a battle, which is really humiliating for the militia. And there are, I think, 15 people from Illinois, the Illinois militia, that are killed. And Lincoln is out and sees those bodies and is, you know, pretty disturbed by them. And then later on, there's a confrontation at Kellogg's Grove, and Lincoln sees the bodies of the dead Americans and remarks about them having been scalped. But he himself claims to have never fired a shot in anger, never saw a hostile Indian, but claims he had a lot of confrontations and a great deal of blood loss as a result of the mosquitoes.
We're going to follow the Black Hawk War to its conclusion when we continue with University of the Year. Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Cary Trask, and we're talking about his book Black Hawk, The Battle for the Heart of America, the War of 1832 that was played out right in our region here. There have been a lot of famous names already with Abraham Lincoln and Andrew Jackson, and I understand that Zachary Taylor and Jefferson Davis also come into this story. How do they fit?
Boy, it really is it's a star-clustered cast.
Cozy
here.
Little
it really
war,
truly
isn't it?
Is a cozy little war. You know, you have to remember the United States is a small country at the time. But Jefferson Davis is fairly fresh out of West Point. He's stationed originally at Fort Winnebago in Portage, is then transferred to Fort Crawford at Prairie du Chien, and the commanding officer at Prairie du Chien was Zachary Taylor, and Zachary Taylor was an old veteran. I mean, Taylor had been involved, like Black Hawk, in the War of 1812, and Taylor's a colonel in the Army. And, of course, Taylor eventually goes on in the 1840s to become president of the United States, and Jefferson Davis goes on to become the president of the Confederacy. But their relationship is even closer because, you know, these cold winter nights in Wisconsin, with very few opportunities for social life, Jefferson Davis hooks up with Zachary Taylor's daughter, and so Davis becomes Taylor's son-in-law. And in the meantime, you have Abraham Lincoln, who's not a West Point grad and is a captain for a while in the militia. But there's no indication, in spite of what Mrs. Davis later wrote, that Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln ever met. But Lincoln did meet a man by the name of Robert Anderson, who happens to later be the commander of Fort Sumter on the first day of the Civil War when Confederates in Charleston open up fire on the fort there. And in fact, this Robert Anderson is the person who swears Lincoln in. They kind of get federalized, you know, they therefore are under the command of federal officers. And Anderson swears Lincoln in. And there are a great many other people who later turn up in more famous roles in the Civil War, like Albert Sidney Johnson, for one.
Famous Confederate general.
Yeah, famous Confederate general, yeah.
So is Black Hawk leading this band of Sauk north into Wisconsin just really in an evasive maneuver? Just his strategy really just to keep ahead of the pursuing troops and militia, or does he have something else in mind?
That's partly it. But, you know, before Black Hawk had ever crossed over the Mississippi, he had been busy during the winter. In fact, for a number of winters before that, trying to build a much larger Indian alliance. Black Hawk really does sort of follow the ideas of Tecumseh.
I was going to say, who actually did a tour
of
the Southeast.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And there are Sauk leaders that go as far south as Texas and Louisiana, trying to interest other tribes in getting involved in a much bigger alliance. Because Black Hawk really believes that the land belongs to the Indians in general. This is a kind of a pan-Indian idea that transcends tribalism. And that's very much a reflection of Tecumseh's thoughts. And he really is trying to put together this alliance, and there's all kinds of red wampum being sent out during the 1831-32 winter. And he doesn't know whether people have been attracted to this idea or not, but he has some promises, it seems, from some of the Winnebago, the Rock River Winnebago, the ones that live around Beloit, and a number of the Potawatomi that live in southern Wisconsin around Lake Geneva and northern Illinois. And he thinks that if he gets further up the Rock River Valley, he'll get into their territory, they'll give him refuge, and they may even, in fact, come to his support in a military way. So he's looking for friendly territory. And so that's the reason why he continues to head north along the Rock River and then cross over at Turtle Creek, which is where Beloit is, and then head up through Janesville and then into right around where Fort Atkinson now is. And at that point, he knows he's not going to get support. He knows he's not going to get support. So he's really on the run by that time.
Do you think he knows that the end is inevitable? In other words, that he cannot win against the larger military force that's going to come after him?
I think he does know that. I think he knows that he may not be able to, like, stand and confront them and do anything in a military way. And besides, that's not their style of warfare. He has led some raids all the way back to where Elizabeth, Illinois is now in the Apple River Valley. But he knows he's not going to whip the Americans in terms of a military confrontation. And his hope is that if he can outrun them and get all the way across Wisconsin and cross over the Mississippi River, they can then sort of vanish into the uncharted West. And that's the plan. I mean, when he's at Lake Koshkonong, the plan is like, okay, let's bust out of here. Let's head west. He goes through the Winnebago villages that are at Four Lakes, which is here, and then they cross the Wisconsin River near Sauk City. And before they cross the Wisconsin River at Sauk City, there is a battle. And it's called the Battle of Wisconsin Heights. And there's a plaque there now.
On Highway 12, yes.
On Highway 12,
going up
yeah.
toward from Madison to Baraboo.
Yeah, there was a commemoration ritual there this past summer on the 175th anniversary of the battle.
Did they get across the Wisconsin?
Most of them did get across the Wisconsin, yeah. You know, all along the way, of course, people are dying. Some Sauk die in the Battle of Stillman's Run. There's tremendous hunger when they're in the swamp region around where UW-Whitewater now is. And, you know, people are, while they're on the run, a lot of them are surviving on their dead horses. But a lot of people do get across the Wisconsin because what takes place there is that Henry Dodge and some of the Illinois militia are hot on their trail. I mean, they have picked up their trail. They have followed them through Four Lakes. They have cut up through what now is Dane County, and they catch up with them about a half a mile from the Wisconsin River, where there are sort of bluffs on two sides. And Blackhawk stops there and has about 180 or maybe fewer than 200 warriors who then take up a position on the one bluff. And their whole purpose in doing that is to hold off Dodge and the militia so that the women, children, and old people can make it across the river.
Are they using guns?
They're using guns. They are using guns, both sides. Certainly, some of the native warriors are still using traditional weapons, but most of them are using guns. And they dismount from their horses, and really it's a very smart move because by the time Dodge catches up with them, it's late in the afternoon. It's July the 21st. There's a rainstorm so that the sky is dark. And if Blackhawk and his warriors can hold until dark, then they think everybody is going to be able to get across the river. So it's a real holding action, and it's very costly to the Sauk. And in fact, there's some Kickapoo with Blackhawk. Some of the Kickapoo, who are also worried about removal, have joined up with the Blackhawk Band as early as the winter of 31 when they're in Iowa. And they're very, very ferocious. The Kickapoo are sort of front line at the Battle of Wisconsin Heights, and virtually all the Kickapoo warriors, maybe 100 of them, are killed at Wisconsin Heights. But they hold, and the women and the children do, in fact, get across. The women and the children, the old people, and the adolescents, they do get across the Wisconsin River. And it's seen as a fairly remarkable maneuver because, geez, with children and old people. I mean,
much slower than the troops.
Yeah, and there's this, like, wow, they're under attack and there's going to be panic and disorganization and confusion. But they do it. They do it. And then they vanish into the forest west of the river. Now, a number of people that don't have good horses, if they're going to make it to the Mississippi, of course, they're going to have good horses. And a number of people that don't have good horses or don't have horses at all try to make it down the Wisconsin. The goal on both counts is to get down to the Mississippi and get across as quickly as possible and vanish. And a lot of the people that make rafts or makeshift canoes and try to get down the Wisconsin River, a lot of them don't make it.
How does it all end finally?
Well, it never all ends. I mean, but, it culminates.
The war.
And you refer to it as a questionable triumph in something you've written.
Oh, yeah.
What's the question and what happens?
Well, what happens is the Sauk make it to the Mississippi. They make it to the Mississippi, and they start to try to cross over on the 1st of August. And, no sooner try to get across the river than a steamboat called the Warrior, heading down from Fort Snelling, which is where the Twin Cities now is located, and equipped with a cannon and with some troops on board, open fire, and they can't get across the river. The Warrior continues to fire on them until early evening on the 1st of August, and then running out of fuel, the Warrior heads downriver to Prairie du Chien. Comes back the next day, though. And in the meantime, Henry Dodge and his militia and Atkinson have hooked up. They've hooked up at Blue Mound, and they cross the river near Spring Green, and they're heading off in pursuit. And they're camped the night of August the 1st, about 10 miles away from the Mississippi. And the army gets up at 2 o'clock in the morning, knowing that they're closing in. And the Sauk may or may not know. I mean, there's a rear guard. But the Sauk may or may not know that the whole army, or what's left of the whole army, is closing in on them. And the army, in fact, gets to the bluff at what's now called Victory on the Mississippi, north of Prairie du Chien, just south of the mouth of the Bad Axe River, where it flows into the Mississippi and hits the Indian camp, which is down on the bank of the river. And when the Warrior comes back, they're caught from two sides. I mean, there are islands there in the Mississippi, and, the Indians that are trying to get across are hit by the people on the steamboat, and the army is pouring down the bluff, and just massacring people. And it's hard to know how many Sauk people there were at what's called the Battle of Bad Axe. Less than 1,000. But, you know, maybe 200 get across the river. But when, in early afternoon, the clubbing and the shooting and the stabbing and the, you know, the violence is over, there are only 39 Indians that are left to be taken captive, and they're all women and small children. And there are some horrendous scenes of militiamen shooting Indian children and scalping people, Indian people who aren't yet dead, and, you know, cutting off pieces of long pieces of skin to later be used as razor straps. It's pretty violent and pretty ghoulish stuff. And there's a real kind of bloodlust frenzy in the whole thing on the part especially of the militia. And it's a victory, of course, but it's a victory that, boy, in retrospect, is not one that we should really celebrate or be proud of.
That's really, though, what opened up the Wisconsin Territory.
It's really
what
white
settlement.
Yeah, it really does.
And the fate of Black Hawk himself?
Oh, the fate of Black Hawk. Black Hawk managed to survive. Black Hawk is taken prisoner, imprisoned in St. Louis at Jefferson Barracks. He's later taken with his son and the Winnebago Prophet and a few other Indians east, where they are shown how powerful the United States is through a tour through the major cities out east. And what happens is the Black Hawk really turns into a star. I mean, he really is sort
of... Much like Geronimo.
Yeah,
later.
Really, yeah. And it's sort of like, well, he is the embodied, the noble savage, and people really admire him out there. And,
there's a strange yeah. ambiguity in white America's attitude toward Indians, isn't there? This combination of exterminate
yeah.
and admire
yeah,
at the same
absolutely,
time.
Yeah.
He looks a little haunted in the pictures that are...
Yeah. Black Hawk, of course, does sort of give up the ideas of resisting American expansion after that. And when Black Hawk is in prison out east, there's this succession of famous American artists that go and paint his portrait. And they, of course, want to get it pretty authentic. But at this point, Black Hawk is given a navy blue frock coat and a white shirt and, you know, and a brown hat and a cane. And from the moment he arrives in Washington, D.C., to the rest of his life, he's not a Sauk anymore. I mean, he dresses like a white person. He starts to develop a taste for brandy. And he really is sort of the rock star of his time in 1833 and comes back west and he dictates his autobiography to Anton LeClaire, who's a Métis, who is a government interpreter. And so he becomes famous. I mean, his autobiography becomes a famous piece of literature.
He couldn't fight them, so he joined
yeah.
them. Our guest has been Carrie Trask for this conversation about the Black Hawk War, and quite illuminating it has been. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.